on the other hand, Commodore Chong, the head of their Navy, was of the opinion that of all the services, the Navy in a country is the international service, and one of the international languages is English, so the more people in my Navy that could speak English, the better off they are. And so he was interested in his people learning English. And the third reason was that we drew about 75% of the recruits into the Navy out of the large cities. This was different than the Marines and the Army. But as far as the Navy is concerned, it was kind of a, like the Air Force, a prestige armed force. And so they drew heavily from the cities. What that means is that most of the young recruits had had English in high school. So if you were to ask them to write or read, they probably, many of them, had a facility with English. But what's very difficult for the Vietnamese is to understand and to pronounce, in other words, to communicate. And so what we were doing primarily during that three-month period was developing their communication skills. Now, we knew we didn't have time to teach them the whole language, and so we dwelt on just those words that were necessary to get along aboard ship. And but at the same time, to make it interesting and to give them something else that would be useful, we also taught them various facets of the operation on a PBR. And in fact, we had there kind of a mock-up of a PBR so that they could utilize that. Well, that school was in being in a hotel that we rented, an old abandoned hotel, about an eight-floor one, sometime in December. And there was another thing that was done. Admiral Zumwalt called in the officer in charge of construction out there, who was a CB, or a civil engineering corps officer, and told him he wanted a new set of barracks and a new set of classrooms at the what used to be the recruit training center at Cam Ranh Bay. And this was part of our plan too, is that we would take the recruits and not train them by the Navy, but we would have the Army do all of the recruit training. And then we would take the people up at the Naval Training Center at Cam Ranh Bay and give them a basic training up there. And at the same time, I mean basic skill training. And at the same time, we would double the capacity of that school. So, in a real unprecedented effort, the construction people put together a doubling of that capacity at Cam Ranh Bay in something like 36 days, or some unreasonable figure.
Can't do it.
That. That's right. But this did two or three things. By the boat school in Saigon, and by this fast construction period up there in Cam Ranh Bay, it served notice in no uncertain terms to everybody who saw it that the United States Navy really meant business when they were going to try to help the Vietnamese Navy actually more than double in size and take over the operation of a lot of units.
Let me ask, that may be a very stupid question, but it bothers me a little. When Zumwalt goes there on practically no notice at all, with a kind of a real new presentation, which involves giving away a lot of Navy property and to somebody else and all that kind of stuff, doesn't he have to clear that somewhere in the Navy before he can tell Abrams that's what we propose to do?
Parts of, yes, the answer is yes. And some of this documentation came back to the Navy. Were things back to the Navy saying this is what I was
Well, did you have time to. Before you ever got to Abrams to, you know, do you have time to talk to somebody and say, is it all right if I propose this to Abrams?
Some of the things, you see, were in the five-year program. And we were cutting 5 years to 1 year, or 1.5 years, or something like that.
Some of them were within his prerogatives as commander.
That's right. We did play a little catch-up with the authorities over the next couple of weeks.
Yeah,
but
there were no kickbacks about that.
No, not really. We got a couple of messages saying, not quite sure what you, what all this means that we just got. We want to support you, but... And finally, he felt the best way to explain it was to send a briefing team back here to give Admiral Moore and to give Sink Pack Fleet the same briefing that he had given to General Abrams. It was just an easier thing to do.
Yeah.
So he sent that commander who worked for me that I said was turning the slides with me and another commander out of the military assistance office that we had over there who knew the five-year program, and he sent them back, and they briefed St. Pat Fleet, and then they briefed...
Who was St. Pat Fleet, the Grant at that time?
No, at that time it was Johnny Hyland, Admiral Hyland. And...
So there wasn't
and
any...
And St. Pat at the time, St. Pat, of course, was a joint command.
Yeah.
That, at the time, was Admiral McCann.
That... there wasn't any static... As a result, really.
There was a little bit.
A little bit.
Because in our plan, I had inadvertently given away more than we really owned. And so it would have caused the building program to be quite as ambitious as what we put in there. And, you know, Admiral Zumwalt had caught this. I've got to take full responsibility for that. And so
somebody in Washington.
So somebody in Washington said, "Hell, you're not helping us any by committing us to a multi-million-dollar building program." So we had to quit regroup.
Yeah.
And one of the ways we made that up, what that was in the Armored River Reinforcement. Now, what we were going to do was replace. Some of the old forces that the Vietnamese Navy had with a modernized craft of the type that we were using. What we ended up doing, since we were not able, since you know I had shown the figures that were more than what we had in our inventory, what we ended up doing was turning over a reasonable amount, which was most of what we had in our inventory, and then instead of replacing, the Vietnamese Navy kept their old forces that were somewhat of the same nature. So they had roughly about 500 craft, and our program, which was to complete and was designed this way over that weekend, it was to complete by the end of fiscal year 72, and this was in fiscal year 72. Well, let me say it was to complete by July of 72, which was end of, yeah. It was to complete by July of 72.
Something under three and a half, it's about 3.5 year program.
Well, we were talking, no, sir, we were talking, this was the end of 68. So we had
3.5 years. July of 72.
Let's see, we had from July of 60, yeah, 3.5 years. But most of the stuff was to be turned over before that, and the last year was mostly a logistics catch-up, turning over the bases and all that sort of thing.
Of course, but one of the things here, one of the larger implications of this whole story is that what has become known as Vietnamization was actually kind of a beginning of Johnson program, not a Nixon-Laird program.
That's a fact. And very few people know that.
Well,
but before Nixon ever was even elected, Admiral Zumwalt came over there with the idea that that was the way to go. And then Mr. Johnson gave the directions to General Abrams, and then you heard how we fit into that.
Yeah, right.
So what it turned out, sir, was that we gave about 1,000 craft away, and that meant they went from a 500 craft Navy to a 1,500 craft Navy, and the largest being several destroyer escort size ships. And they went in strength from about 17,000, and they had just recently doubled over the previous 3 years from about 8,000. When Admiral Zumwalt got there, they were something around 17,000, and they finally peaked out around 42,000. At 42,000, as far as numbers of people are concerned, they were something like the ninth largest navy in the world. You know, they're navies that have a lot more tonnage,
yeah.
but they don't have that many people. Yeah.
Here's something that needs to be put in perspective, it seems to me. Realistically, what part of the total American effort in Vietnam did the Navy represent? Not necessarily just in terms of numbers, which was a small part in terms of numbers, obviously, but, you know, in terms of importance of weight in any way, how important to the whole effort was the Navy effort? Was it a minor part of the whole enterprise, or was it a vital part, or a significant part, or, you know, what? Just your kind of opinion, and so all you can give is your opinion, obviously.
I have pieces of a briefing here. How much time do you want to spend on that?
Not just a hell of a lot, just enough to put me on track when I talk to Zumwalt about it.
Okay. It's hard to tell you percentage-wise. I can't say 5% of the effort or something like that. But the Navy, or a Navy, was a sine qua non for successful completion of any type of operation in Vietnam for a couple of reasons. For one thing, they have something like 1,250 miles of coastline. And starting around or up till about 1965, most all of the resupply of any North Vietnamese forces and any resupply of the South Vietnamese Viet Cong was by sea, around the coastline. They'd come down in trawlers from Haiphong, and they'd come down to the Delta and other places. All along the coast, they were resupplying the Viet Cong. As a matter of fact, you get down into the Delta, and they had a very interesting operation down there. There's a what amounts to a peninsula that's completely cut by waterways, but so in a way it's kind of an island. But it's the whole southern tip of the Mekong Delta Peninsula there is mangrove swamp, and quite a heavy coverage there. And they used that as kind of a surge tank, and they would offload down there. And then they could resupply up north to the whole Delta there. And then with any problem, they could withdraw into this place where they were fairly well sanctuaried. Yes, sir, it was impossible. I'll tell you, fighting that war is like submarine warfare. It's not, two-thirds of the battle is finding out where the guy is. Maybe 98% is finding out where he is, and then the fight ensues. But the biggest part is finding the guy. And so they resupplied quite consistently. Now, around 65, we started an operation on the coast called Market Time, and it consisted of several barriers. An air barrier that flew around 100, 150 miles off the shore.
Navy air?
Yes, sir. Then there was an outer surface barrier, which was destroyer escorts, LSTs, minesweepers, Coast Guard high endurance cutters, and these sorts of things. There was always about eight of them on station around the coast. And they all had a piece of the coast that they would patrol back and forth.
So they're picket duty.
Yes, sir. Now this is over and above the gun line. In other words, the ships that were to fire gun, that were to supply gunfire support to troops in Vietnam. The gunfire support ships did not come under Admiral Zumwalt. They came under the 7th Fleet. But the outer barrier, surface barrier, did. These people actually changed their operational control to Admiral Zumwalt when they got on station there.
Oh, I see. They were from the 7th Fleet, but they...
That's right.
The air was 7th Fleet.
The air was 7th Fleet, but we controlled it once they got into the...
Once they got in the air.
Once they got to the patrol position for the Market Time patrol, then it was controlled, and we did it centrally from Cameron Bay. And then there was an inshore barrier, which was made up of about 100 of these little 50-foot aluminum boats called Swift Boats. PCFs. They had good armament on them, a couple 50 calibers, and they had grenade launchers and mortars. And there was a lot of gunfire from this little boat, and it was fairly seaworthy up to a fairly good sea. In a real, real heavy sea, they'd have to. But, so you had the three barriers, the air barrier, then the outer surface barrier, and then the inshore barrier. And then Admiral Zumwalt, in his description of this, always likes to describe a fourth barrier, which is the stretches of friendly controlled area on the coast itself. But these are all barriers to infiltration. Once that was set up, the amount of infiltration by sea really cut down. And I guess there were as many as eight or so trawlers over a several-year period that did try it and got turned back. A couple of them got sunk.
Some of them probably got through.
Undoubtedly. But very few. It really did seriously curtail the infiltration by sea. This caused the North Vietnamese to have to resupply down through the Ho Chi Minh Trail, down through Laos, through Cambodia.
Much more expensive than...
And then come across at various places from Cambodia. They used Cambodia as a sanctuary, which if people really watched that operation could not be against the bombing in Cambodia. It's just ridiculous. We were playing a football game where the other side could advance the ball by going out of bounds and coming in 30 yards down the field, and we couldn't go out of bounds to tackle and just fight them out.
Well, I guess there wouldn't be quite much fuss about it if everybody leveled about what was really going on instead of pretending it wasn't when it was. Maybe that's one of the problems.
But at any rate, so then what you had was the necessity for the Viet Cong to be resupplied across the Cambodian border. Now,
which took more out of them, I think.
So what they were doing was they were coming down through Laos and through Cambodia.
Yeah.
And there was a little bit of resupply up in here, but the big resupply was down the main branches of the Mekong first.
Yeah.
And because from there they could get all kinds of waste. So then we started an operation, and what I'm talking so
far... Was this your place down, way down there that you were talking
yeah.
about before?
Yeah. That surge tank was this little area right here. There's a river that comes in here that joins with the river that comes in here. That, so you can get all the way across there.
Yeah.
This all happened before Admiral Zumwalt got over there, but I'm just trying to tell you the importance of the Navy mission over there. So then what they started doing is coming down the main branches of the Mekong. Then we started an operation there that was called, code name was Game Warden. And this was primarily on the main branches themselves. There are, by the time it gets out to the South China Sea here, there are about nine different places, but there are nine different branches. These were all done by PBRs, which are the little 28-foot fiberglass boats that had grenade launchers and 50 calibers on them. And then the guys themselves had M16s and small arms and things like
that. Well,
that
would be more firepower than the other folk mostly had, wouldn't it?
Well, the other folks had had rockets, and they had air machine guns, rapid fire. Depends.
Mm.
Depends. Now, so the Game Warden was to stop infiltration on the main rivers there.
Yeah.
And then the other operation that was going on that the Navy was engaged in, and that is there are a whole lot of little intricate canal systems. This whole area south of Saigon is just one big checkerboard of canals. And so the 9th Infantry Division, which was down here just around the Kanto area, around in this area, right around in here. It was near Mito. It was right here. This was the home of the 9th Infantry Division, which I'm going to talk about here again in a minute. They were embarked in armored craft that we had over there, which was called the Riverine Forces. This was another task force that we had. This consisted of about four or five different kinds of craft. There were, you know, those old LCMs, those well-type little small craft that used for Liberty parties?
Yeah.
Well, we had a lot of those things with little machine guns lined up on the side, and we'd carry 50, 80 troops in those things, depending on whether the U.S. or Vietnamese. About one out of every four or five of those had a little flat top built on top of it that would take a helo, and that was primarily for medevac and people that got hurt. Then there were also some of those that were quite considerably modified. Oh, incidentally, they all had armor on the side of them, put onto the side. And there were some that were modified to the extent that they put a whole flat front on the thing and put a huge gun on the front, made either a 40 millimeter machine gun like we carry aboard some of the ships, or a 105 millimeter howitzer, one of the two, and of course that was dubbed the Monitor. And then we had another modification that had a whole lot of, but also had a big gun up front, but it also had a whole lot of communications equipment. So that you had yourself a whole armored armada that could wend its way through the canal system and the tributaries, carrying quite a large number of troops. If you had maybe 8 or 10 of these small craft, you might be able to carry all together 500 or so troops.
It drew very little water in here.
Yes, sir. It was very shallow.
Yeah.
That's right. PBRs, incidentally, were pump boats. They jet pumps, you know. But the others were conventional and screws. So they carried members of the 9th Infantry Division, and they would take over an area by just proceeding up the river and ejecting the troops into an area, and they'd fight and take over an area, or if they got in trouble, they'd get back in the boats, and the boats would also have firepower to protect them. And so this was a formidable force. That kind of kept the Viet Cong off guard in the Delta and enabled us to slowly but surely start trying to take over again some of the waterways. Those are the main things that were going on when Admiral Zumwalt got over there, and it shows the importance of the Navy to the overall operation, mainly on the coast on the main branches to stop infiltration, and then part of the troop force, if you will, in the riverine force down there. Okay, then what Admiral Zumwalt saw was what they then started to do was coming across the border here by hand. And they came down in this area called the Parrot's Beak, which you've heard of, and they come across the border into here and into here. So the infiltration still continued, but
by land. Yeah.
However, it turns out that there is a river that goes in right here and connects to a canal that goes all the way over to the to this part of the, I forget, that's the Mekong itself. You can get there's a crossover up here. There's another series of rivers that go on this side of the Parrot's Beak, and it makes a Y, and another one that goes on this side all the way up here to Tainan and up above that, as a matter of fact, all the way up in here. And then there's a canal system that connects this part of the Bassac with this river. So in effect, there is a waterway that covers 250 more miles of the border from the Gulf of Siam and all the way around the Parrot's Beak and almost to the border right up in here. And the bulk of the infiltration that had anything to do with the Saigon or the Delta area was coming through here. So we put boats on this thing, and this is the thing that Admiral Zumwalt did. I think he started out over here with trying to get some of these small 50-foot aluminum craft making incursions into these rivers. He came across here, and they just kept probing into these rivers, and they kept probing into here, and it turned out fairly successful. Then what he started doing is mixing up his forces, and he would use the heavy armored craft, almost like the battleship of the river. He'd use the small fiberglass boats, almost like the destroyers, and he formed one operation at a time, I think, as I recall, first this one, then this one, which he called Giant Slingshot, because it was in the form of a giant slingshot, and then finally this connecting one right here, so that he had a waterway infiltration, interdiction of the infiltration of this 250-mile area. Once he started doing this, he was moving, or he opened these two rivers that were not open before he started that. The Army told him he was crazy, and then they were delighted because they were starting to be able to move. The Army always has a lot of boats too for logistic support, and they were able to get their boats going again for supplying little outposts up in this area up in here. Mm-hmm.